Welcome to NatSec Tech, a podcast from the Special Competitive Studies Project. I'm Jean Meserve, and it's great to have you with us. It is a complicated world, and our guest today maintains that the moment we are in is the most dangerous period we've confronted since 1940. Not because of the Israel-Hamas conflict, not because of the war in Ukraine, but because of China and its military, political, and economic ambitions. Dmitry Alperovich is a cybersecurity and geopolitics expert. A few highlights from his very impressive resume. He is a co-founder and former chief technology officer of CrowdStrike, executive chairman of the Silverado Policy Accelerator, a nonprofit focused on advancing American prosperity and global leadership. He is an advisor to the Department of Homeland Security and was previously a special advisor to the Department of Defense. And he is the author of a new book, World on the Brink. Dmitry, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jean.
So, Dmitry, before we get down to the book, I have to ask you about CrowdStrike, the company that you co-founded. It was recently awarded the Most Epic Fail Award at the DEF CON Hacking Conference for the software update that caused a global IT outage. What lessons should we learn from that?
Well, you know, I should qualify that I retired from the company 4.5 years ago, so I have nothing to do with this recent episode. But obviously, it's a blemish on the company and, you know, probably the whole industry, because having an impact like that is problematic, to say the least. And obviously, so many people inconvenienced, so much loss in terms of economic productivity that happened over that week or 2 week period when all the disruptions are occurred. So CrowdStrike has to do better. The whole industry has to do better. One of the problems here is that all security software really on the endpoint, as it's called, on your desktops, on your servers, has to be in the kernel of the operating system, particularly on the Microsoft Windows operating system, sort of in the heartbeat of that operating system, because you want to make sure that you're on the same level playing field as the bad guys, right? The malware that may get on the system and so forth. And when you're in the kernel, inevitably that introduces a lot of risk, because if there is a bug, the operating system can't recover from it. It blue screens and causes the problems that we saw. So, you know, Microsoft, I think, is going to be looking at how do you minimize the need to be in the kernel for both security vendors and, frankly, most everyone else, and push as much of the functionality of the security vendors down into so-called user mode, where if something crashes, it's just the application that's affected. It's not the whole system.
That approach, is that enough in your view, or does even more need to be looked at or undertaken?
Well, you know, CrowdStrike put out a root cause analysis that talked about a lot of things that they have to do internally, improve testing, for example, and so forth. So I think individual companies will do a lot more. Rollouts of updates will be done hopefully more carefully going forward, where you do so-called ring deployments, where you deploy to a small set of customers and a bigger set of customers, and then bigger from there, as opposed to everyone at once, where, you know, you can have a huge population being affected by an update that has a bug. So there's a lot that I think people are going to be looking at, both at the company as well as really everyone in the industry.
Sticking to cybersecurity for just another minute, I have to ask you about election interference. There's a history, of course, in 2016, and we're already seeing allegations of Iranian meddling with the campaigns. What do you think we're likely to see in the coming months?
Well, you know, election interference from foreign state actors has really become a way of life for us now since really 2016. In every major presidential election, at least, you've seen some sort of attempts to interfere by various state actors. In 2020, we also saw the Iranians trying to interfere and trying to impact Donald Trump's campaign, as they're doing now. So I think that's just the reality of modern day campaigning, that we have adversaries out there, the four primary ones, of course, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, that are doing a variety of things to us, both in cyber domain and outside of cyber domain. And yeah, they're going to try to mess with our elections. They're going to try to impact people's view of candidates. I think a lot of that stuff gets overblown in terms of impact. The reality is that most of the stuff just does not work. And the less the media actually hypes it up, the better. And I think they handle it exactly the right way this time around. They didn't publish the leaked data that they received, the publications that got it. They said this is happening and they moved on. And, you know, it was a 24-hour story and it moved on.
Do all of these actors, and you've mentioned four of them, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, do they all have the same objectives?
Yeah. Well, I should make it clear, we haven't seen North Korea do direct election interference. They focus on other things. China, also in cyber, really has not been prominent on the election interference stuff. So it's mostly been Russia and Iran, at least in terms of our elections and direct cyber interference. But, you know, the goals may be different. I think Iran in particular is very much opposed to Trump, I think in part because of the assassination of Soleimani. They famously still have an effort underway to try to assassinate him and others that have been involved in that decision making. The Russians, I think, are mostly trying to sow chaos and division to try to make us weaker. So the objectives are a little bit different depending on the actor.
Let's talk about World on the Brink. You say we are at a critical inflection point. How so?
Well, I'm personally very concerned that we are on a march to war. And I think most of the American public, and the reason I wrote this book really, is they do not appreciate how dangerous things are at any moment. And if you go talk to the Indo-Pacific Command based in Hawaii that's responsible for that area of operation in the Pacific, they're preparing for war. You know, if you go to Guam, if you go to Japan, if you go to Taiwan, their preparations underway to fight China, right? And same thing is going in China. And we have not seen a great power war really since World War II. And we've never seen a major nuclear war between two capable nuclear powers. We saw a brief conflict between India and Pakistan, obviously in 99, but very small one. This is something that is incredibly scary, incredibly dangerous. And the risks, I think, are increasing every single day. And the key thing that's different is that you have a leader in China, Xi Jinping, that I believe, and frankly, based on his own public statements, is intent on taking Taiwan, something that has always been a desire, of course, of the Chinese Communist Party leadership going all the way back to Mao, but something that they were willing to push off to sort of future generation, to some undetermined period out far away. And Xi Jinping is different. He talks a lot about how this is a problem, quote unquote, that can be passed off to the future generations. He's contributed and accelerated to a major, just absolutely massive military buildup, both conventional and nuclear, by the way. For the first time since China acquired its nuclear arsenal, they're rapidly increasing it, going from a steady number of about 300 warheads to over 1,000 by the end of the decade, as estimated by the U.S. intelligence community, and trying to match our own numbers of about 1,500 deployed by mid-next decade. And on the conventional side, they already have the world's largest navy in terms of at least number of ships, if not qualitatively, the world's largest missile and rocket arsenal. They're building up submarine capabilities, aircraft carriers, air power as well. So this is getting very, very dangerous. And I think we've been distracted for 20 years, focused on Middle East. Right now, we're obviously a lot of attention is on the war in Gaza and the war in Ukraine. But this is a crisis that is brewing and is getting more dangerous by the day.
In the event there is war, is the U.S. ready? Is Taiwan ready?
Well, I think that we are capable today of defeating the Chinese invasion. The United States is. I don't think the Taiwanese are. And the Taiwanese are in really bad shape, in part because they've completely neglected a focus on their military over the last 20 years. They've sort of been lulled, as we have been, by the economic engagement with China, thinking that that is going to liberalize their system, make war less likely. And of course, Xi Jinping has completely appended all of that. They're now trying to increase spending. Their overall spending, when you count both the supplemental and regular budget spend, is about 3%, just a little bit below that. But frankly, given that they're 3% of GDP, given that their GDP is much, much smaller than China's, this is still highly inadequate. And it's not that they have to match, nor can they, China's dollar for dollar, but they have to focus on a lot more asymmetric capabilities. They've been focused on traditional large-scale systems that are very expensive, F-16s, M1 Abrams tanks, indigenously built submarine. Those are the types of things that cost a lot of money that don't get you a whole lot of value. Tanks, for example, I think are nearly useless in the Taiwan conflict scenario because it's a mountainous terrain. This is not the fields of Ukraine where you're going to have these massive tank battles happening. F-16s are a great capability to try to confront Chinese Air Force and sort of these gray zone intrusions into their air defense zone. But in real conflict, they have too few of them, and they have a relatively few number of runways, which you can expect to be cratered. So the idea that they would be taking off in large numbers to confront the Chinese Air Force is also not realistic. They need to invest in missiles. They need to invest in air defense. They need to invest in drones. They need to invest in smart mines. And they're doing some of that, but it's too slow. When it comes to the U.S., as I mentioned, we are capable today of defeating the Chinese, and the Chinese are not yet ready. And Xi Jinping knows that he's not ready because we know, based on the revelations from CIA Director Burns, that he has given an order to his military to be ready to invade by 2027.
Are we investing enough in those asymmetric warfare capabilities?
Slowly but surely, yes. We need to accelerate a lot of that. The problem that we've had, frankly, in our defense industrial base, and it's really coming to the fore with this attempt to support Ukraine and their war, is that we focused on highly exquisite, highly capable weapon systems that cost too much and are too difficult to manufacture at high numbers, right? And what we've learned from Ukraine is that wars can go on for a long time, and you tend to expend a lot of munitions when you're fighting a great power. So, you know, in some estimates, we use up most of our magazines in terms of missiles in a conflict with China within the first 7 to 10 days. And then what, right? Then you're not going to be able to rebuild them quickly. So we need to focus on lowering the cost, on making this much more mass production activity than the exquisite sort of artisan crafting that you have going on right now with these large weapon systems. And I think part of that has to do with changing the model for defense procurement as well. Most of the defense procurement contracts we have today with companies like Lockheed and Raytheon and others are cost plus. In other words, the cost of the weapon system is X. They're going to get a margin for profit on top of that. And that's how we purchase F-35s and so forth. And the problem with that is that it creates the wrong incentives, because if you're one of these defense contractors, you want to sell the most expensive thing possible, right? Because that's how you're going to make the most money. But if you move to a fixed cost procurement model, like we do in the commercial space, then you incentivize actually volume production at a cheaper cost, right? And you can get a lot more bang for your buck. It won't be as exquisite. It won't be as capable. But frankly, you know, when these platforms are costing so much money, we just can't afford to be always at the most advanced edge. And I have one example in the book that I particularly want to highlight, and that's the Ford-class aircraft carriers. Now, there are a lot of people that are criticizing the aircraft carriers. I'm not one of them. I still think that they are instrumental for U.S. power projection. When you park one next to the shores of another nation with its massive air wing on board, everyone notices, and it's a huge deterrent, and it's a huge, hugely capable force that you can use to project power all over the world. They're vulnerable, yes. They're more vulnerable today, perhaps, but they've always been vulnerable. We've lost a number of them during World War II, of course. However, we've for decades have been buying this Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, which is 40% larger than the Chinese carriers, way better than theirs, way better than anyone else's, frankly. And it costs about $4 billion. Not cheap, but, you know, You can afford to buy a bunch of them at that price tag. But, you know, the Navy said, no, that's not good enough. We want the next generation. We want the Ford class, which costs $14 billion, 3.5 times the price of the Nimitz, which was already the best in the world, right? Are we getting 3.5 times the value? No, we're not, right? So we don't always need to go for the bigger and better and more expensive. Particularly when the defense budget is $900 billion already, with the $35 trillion deficit, you're not going to be able to increase it massively. So you need to use that money more wisely and focus on lowering the cost, focus on volume that will enable you to do the right things and deter in China.
Many people are talking about China's vulnerabilities right now. You mentioned they're not ready militarily, but they're also facing demographic challenges, economic challenges. Are you exaggerating the danger that China poses?
I don't think so. So let's talk about demographics. They have a huge demographics problem. You're absolutely right. They have about 1.4 billion people today. By the end of the century, they're estimated to get to 550 million. Just an enormous population collapse we haven't seen in world history. But you know what? We have 330 million today. So 550 million is still a lot of people. They have serious problems in their economy. It's still growing, by the way. It's still growing 3 to 4% a year, slightly bigger than ours. So it's not a catastrophe. It's not a collapse. By the way, North Korean economy is a total disaster. And guess what? They're able to invest in significant military capabilities, submarines, et cetera. They're supplying Russia right now. So just because your economy is no longer growing as well as it used to be, maybe you're on a path to stagnation, does not mean that you can not invest, particularly in an authoritarian country, in significant military capabilities, right? And North Korea certainly poses a threat. Iran poses a threat. Iran's been under sanctions for God knows how long. And they're right now, as we speak, threatening to hit Israel, right? So this idea that just because the economics are bad or there's a demographics problem, that China will not still present a big threat to us, I just don't think that's likely at all.
Do you think conflict is inevitable?
I don't think it's inevitable. I think that Xi Jinping wants to resolve this issue, as he calls it, in his lifetime. The man is now 71, right? So I think he's looking at the next 10, maybe 15 years of his life in power, at least, as a potential window. There is I don't think he's penciled the date certain in the calendar. I think that potentially the 2028 through 2032 period is very, very dangerous. So next 4 to 8 years, but he's still deterrable. And in part, he's deterrable because the risks of failure are so existential for him. And this is where things are different between him and Putin, right? I've argued for 2.5 years now since this conflict in Ukraine began, which I was one of the first ones to have predicted. Back in December of 2021, I said he's going to invade Ukraine before the end of that winter. But I've said for 2.5 years that he could declare victory tomorrow, Putin. He could say, I've denazified Ukraine, I've demilitarized them, whatever that even means, pull out back to 2022 borders, and no one in Russia is going to blink an eye. No one deeply cares about Ukraine and Russia except him, right? So he can afford, what might be a loss and still survive politically. Xi Jinping does not have that luxury, because if he goes against Taiwan and he loses much of the Chinese invasion fleet, for example, that could be the end of him. That could be the end of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think he's keenly aware of those risks. So we need to make sure that he is thinking about those dilemmas that would be presented to him in this invasion, which is very, very difficult to orchestrate, by the way. Would be, if he goes for it, would be the most complicated military operation in the history of humanity. That's how difficult it is, right? Just to give you one example, back in June of this year, we celebrated the 80th anniversary of D-Day, Operation Overlord, 150,000-160,000 Allied troops crossing the English Channel, which is about the size of the Taiwan Strait, to land on the beaches of Normandy and ultimately liberate Europe. This month, in August, is actually the 80th anniversary of another amphibious invasion, which never took place. It was called Operation Causeway. It was put together by the Joint Staff to invade Taiwan, or Formosa, as it was called at the time, which was, of course, occupied by the Japanese. It called for double the number of people on D-Day, over 300,000 troops. They estimated 45,000 casualties and really brutal fighting on that island. Very complex operation, much more complex than Normandy. And ultimately, Roosevelt, MacArthur, and the rest of the leadership looked at it and said, no, this is too hard, right? So 80 years ago, for the United States military, which has just pulled off the most amazing amphibious invasion in history, they thought this was hard. It's only gotten harder since then. So we need to make sure it stays really, really hard. And ultimately, he decides that it's impossible.
Some Americans wonder, why should we care? If China should succeed in this effort to reunite Taiwan with mainland China, what are the ramifications?
So I'm going to correct you slightly there, Gene, because that word reunite, of course, is a loaded word because the Taiwanese do not believe that they've ever been united with China. And
but that's right, the objective of Xi.
Yeah. So he talks about reunification. I talk about unification because the history of Taiwan is that it's never actually been fully controlled by anyone who fully controlled China. Why should America care? Well, oftentimes the debate around Taiwan in America, to the extent that there is one even, gets reduced to semiconductors, to chips. Taiwan manufactures a huge number of them, not just about 90% of all advanced chips, but about 40% of the so-called foundational chips that are even more vital to our economy. So they're a huge producer of semiconductors. And by the way, that's not going away. A lot of people think that the CHIPS Act, which I'm a big supporter of, really important to invest in American production of semiconductors, will reduce our reliance on Taiwan. It won't. The Taiwanese will dominate the sector for many decades to come. And the CHIPS Act is really not going to change that. The CHIPS Act is all about sustaining our industry. And actually, to the extent that we're going to increase market share, it'll probably come at the expense of Korea versus Taiwan. So Taiwan will still be vitally important. But, you know, you can't reduce Taiwan to chips. First of all, it is a democracy. It is a thriving democracy. Its people love freedom and have benefited from the opening of that country after a brutal dictatorship was taken down in the 1990s. But more importantly than that, it is a geostrategically vital place. General Douglas MacArthur in 1950, long before chips, long before the age of computing, called Taiwan an unsinkable aircraft carrier. And its position in the Indo-Pacific is just so critical because it's effectively the cork that keeps China bottled up, because China has a fundamental issue beyond the issues we've just discussed of demographics and economics. The other big issue is geography. It is effectively contained, completely contained today by U.S. allies and U.S. military. So when it looks out at the world, to its east, it has the Korean Peninsula, South Korea, 28,000 American troops, naval bases, air bases. Further down, you have the Japanese islands, the headquarters of the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet, 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force on Okinawa, incredible capabilities there. Then right in the center of the Taiwan Strait, facing many of the Chinese ports, is Taiwan, viewed as an outpost of U.S. power, and then closing down that arc of the Philippines, where once again, for the first time in 32 years, we're getting access to the Filipino military bases and getting U.S. troops deployed there. So if you're China, this is not a great position to be in, and particularly if you're Xi Jinping, who I think wrongly believes that China is on the ascendancy and the United States is on the decline and that China will be the world's premier superpower. You can't afford for that to happen, right? You can't afford to be contained by another power like this. So taking Taiwan would essentially uncork them and allow them to dominate the Western Pacific, eject the U.S. out, threaten Japan, threaten the Philippines, threaten Korea. And when I say threaten, I don't necessarily mean that I think that they'll invade those places. I think that's going to be very difficult to pull off, but they can certainly bully them around in a similar way to which Russia bullies around its neighbors, even outside of Ukraine, that obviously and Georgia that it invaded directly.
What does that do to U.S. standing in the world if they do?
Absolutely.
That?
So allowing China to dominate Asia, I think, is incredibly dangerous for us because the U.S. strategy, actually, since the founding of our country, has been to prevent hegemony in areas in which we operate, right? The Monroe Doctrine of the 1800s was, of course, about the Western Hemisphere, where the U.S. at the time had the influence. We wanted to prevent the European powers from dominating our area of influence. Now, of course, our influence is everywhere around the globe, and we want to prevent global hegemony. That's why we wanted to defeat Hitler in World War II. That's why we wanted to defeat Japan from establishing hegemony during World War II as well. That's why we confront the Soviet Union, because we know that if you allow a power to rise like that, ultimately they will expand from their region and bring the war to your doorsteps and influence your national security in a much more direct fashion. But also from an economic perspective, allowing them to dominate a region where you have almost 50% of the world's GDP, and allowing them to set the rules of the security and trade order in that region will be immediately detrimental to U.S. economic power and thus our national security, because ultimately our economy depends on exports, depends on imports. And the more reliant that we're going to become on China, the less safe we will be.
You've mentioned the necessity of the U.S. doing more preparation militarily. But what else should it be doing going forward to brace itself for this possibility?
The technology race, I think, is absolutely critical. So, yes, first and foremost, we have to deter the invasion of Taiwan. But as I argue in the book, we are in a Cold War with China. And Taiwan is that hot flashpoint that could potentially take the two superpowers to war, just like West Berlin served in the first Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. But the Cold War is broader than that. We have an economic competition. We have a tech competition. We have a spy war going on. We have a space race going on. We have global competition for supremacy playing out in every corner of the world. So this is much, much bigger than just Taiwan. And to win that broader Cold War and making sure it stays cold, you have to win the technology race. And I argue in the book that there are four fundamental technologies we have to make sure that we are absolutely dominating and leading China in. And that those are AI and autonomy. And I think for the listeners of this podcast, I don't have to go too deeply into the benefits of that. That's becoming more and more self-obvious for both economic advantage and national security advantage. The second area is biotech, closely related, because I think it will be vastly transformed and is already being vastly transformed by the innovations in AI. And there, you don't just have the medical benefits potentially of custom treatments and tailored drugs and so forth, but you also have the amazing innovations in bioengineering, potentially creating new energy sources in a lab, in biomanufacturing, creating new materials in the lab and the innovations that can come from that. The third area is space. So we've already seen the incredible benefits of lowering the cost of lift into space by companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, and the innovations that come from that, but also the transformation of the satellites, satellite industry in terms of building much more, much smaller, but still highly capable satellites that you can put in low Earth orbit at a fraction of the cost of what you had to spend even a decade ago, revolutionizing communications with technologies like Starlink, navigation, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And it's making it more resilient because you no longer have just a few satellites that can be highly vulnerable to either jamming or being taken out kinetically. So really, really important. And the fourth area, and the first three areas we are the leaders in today. China is trying to catch up, but we're leading. The fourth area is we're losing badly on, and that's green energy. So as we're transitioning our economy to a net zero economy, as we're investing in battery technology, electric vehicles, wind, solar, nuclear, geothermal. Unfortunately, China is leading pretty much in all of these areas, and not just leading, but leading by a huge margin because they've invested in it early on. They've subsidized it massively and have driven a lot of competitors out of business, in part through intellectual property theft, including through cyber. And that's where we need to catch up and make sure that they can dominate. So leading those four critical technologies, I think those four critical technologies, whoever is leading them will determine who wins really the race for the 21st century. And there are, of course, two critical components to those four technologies, and they're semiconductors and critical minerals. And on semiconductors, it's a mixed bag. We've been able to stop Chinese innovation or at least slow it down significantly in the advanced chips. In foundational chips, they're becoming dominant. And in critical minerals, they're dominating processing and refining. So we've got to deal with that.
What are the implications of the U.S. election for this landscape that you've laid out?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that as vastly different as the two parties are on pretty much every issue, on China, there is quite a bit of continuity, right? Most of the China policy of the Trump administration was continued and expanded on in the Biden administration. The tariffs were kept and expanded. The focus on the Indo-Pacific and the military spending increases that started under Trump accelerated under Biden. And I think, you know, regardless of who wins, Trump or Kamala Harris, I think you will see the continuation of that policy. The only question is the velocity right? And I argue in the book that if I'm right and Xi Jinping could potentially launch this war as soon as 2028, we don't have a moment to lose. We got to be faster in lowering our dependency on China in these critical areas like green energy, like semiconductors, like critical minerals. We got to expand our military capabilities in the region to deter him. So we have to do it all and do it much faster. And unfortunately, I think with both parties, there's been a desire, as there usually is in politics, to keep kicking the can down the road as much as possible and not take hard decisions. And I just don't think we can afford to do that anymore.
I want to turn a corner here. SESB is spending a lot of time talking about the talent pipeline. What would your advice be to young professionals who are aspiring to make a career in cybersecurity or national security?
Well, that's an easy one. So, I can honestly say that getting into cyber field early on over 25 years ago now has been really positive for my life and my career. So there is sort of a lucrative benefit to being in these technologies. And you've seen that across the board, right? The amount of money that you can now raise for companies doing cyber, doing AI is just astronomical if you've got a good team and a good idea. So there's a life-changing possibility here for someone that wants to get into the space. But the reality is we don't have enough people. And this is another thing that I talk about in the book, that immigration has become a dirty word, unfortunately, in this country. And we need immigrants.
You're an immigrant yourself.
I am, right? And I think the country, if I may be so bold, has benefited from my starting company that now has 7,000 plus people working for it and other contributions that I've made, and as so many others have. As I write in the book, if you look at the seven most valuable companies in the world, which happen to be all but one, Aramco, happen to be American technology companies, they all either were started by immigrants or sons of immigrants, right? Elon Musk from South Africa or currently running by immigrants, right? Google is being run by Sundar Pichai from India. Satya Nadella at Microsoft is an Indian immigrant as well. Jeff Bezos is a son, stepson of a Cuban immigrant. Steve Jobs at Apple was son of a Syrian, right? So immigrants have contributed enormously to our country. And, we've talked about the demographics problems that China is facing. Well, if we didn't have immigration, we'd be in the same boat because we're not giving birth in this country at a sustainable rate either. So if we don't want an economic collapse here, we need people. Now, I do think that we need a smarter immigration policy. I'm not for open borders. I'm not for anyone come in that just wants to jump over the fence. But, the reality is that from a national security perspective, the best way to defeat Russia or Iran or China is to actually take their best people, right? To cause a brain drain and have them come here ideally and contribute to our economy and not contribute to theirs. So there's an offensive element to immigration that is so important. And obviously this country has benefited from that since its founding, right? Our founders were immigrants and so many others that have contributed to so many key projects, like, Enrico Fermi helping to design the atomic bomb was an immigrant from Italy. So we just need to get back to understanding what the core benefits and really vitality of the American society, American ideas are. And as I write about it, it's the five I's. Immigration is one of them. Innovation is another thing. The power of our ideas, the power of our investment and influence in terms of the U.S. military, U.S. alliance network, U.S. dollar, etc. All of that is what really gives us a huge advantage over China, or frankly, anyone else in the world. And we can't forget about that.
Thank you, Dmitry Alperovich, for joining us. Dmitry is executive chairman of the Silverado Policy Accelerator and an advisor to the Department of Homeland Security. He is author of the book, World on the Brink. You've been listening to NatSec Tech, a podcast from the Special Competitive Studies Project. I'm Jean Meserve. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you will again. Take care.